My name is Optimus Prime. Now that I am stuck here on this planet you call Earth, I listen to Inside Movies and TV.
From Toronto, Canada, home of igloos, polar bears, and flying hockey pucks, this is Inside Movies and TV.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. We are tonight's entertainment.
Well, hello there, everyone. Welcome to Inside Movies and TV. This is episode number 62 for the second week of June 2009. Thank you very much for listening. My name is Jamie Hosking, and as always, sitting across from me is Aaron Shaw. Aaron, how's it going?
I'm good. Enough.
Good enough. Yeah.
I'll do it all right.
Excellent, excellent, excellent. So we've got a good podcast today, lots of great stories, both in television and in film. We've got a nice, healthy summer so far for the box office. Very few flops, with the exception of, I guess, what happened last weekend with the new Eddie Murphy movie pretty much tanking.
Yeah.
And
I'm glad you said we've had a healthy summer.
We have.
I'm glad you started at saying this, because I want to say something. I hated Pelham 1-2-3.
Oh, really?
I didn't like that movie one bit.
Yeah, well, that was...
I saw that last weekend.
Yeah, and that was the other one, right?
And I was disappointed. I was really disappointed. I know, I just didn't like... I don't know, maybe it's because I'm starting to look at movies in a different way, you know, since I've been doing all these writing courses and stuff or something like that, but... I, for one, did not like John Travolta in the movie.
He was really?
Too over the top. He likes to drop the mother F-bomb so much,
oh, no.
So much in that movie. It's just a gross overuse of it. And the storyline was, there was no action until maybe the last 20 minutes of the movie, when they decided to move it away from the Denzel Washington's workplace at Traffic Control Center in the train that John Travolta took hostage. And which you never know why he actually did it, or at least it passed me. I don't quite understand his method.
Oh, I see.
That they gave him.
Oh, really?
You know, and like I said, I'm looking at movies maybe a little differently than I used to now. I'm thinking, well, why the hell are they mentioning, you know, things like James Gandolfini's being mayor and, you know, he's having a divorce, and they're like, oh, you know, he's at a press conference while he's going to the train to the traffic control center, and they're like, the press is, you know, doing the press thing that they just bombard with questions, right? And he's like, this is our... He gives his official statement, and they're like, what do you have to say about your divorce? And then they don't pursue it anymore.
Really?
They're just like, oh, he's having a divorce. That doesn't have anything to do with anything else.
That's almost classic for bad movies, isn't
yeah.
it? Yeah, I heard that they were doing some sort of storyline that in that direction, or, in, you know, in some direction it never gets resolved.
Yeah.
It's unfortunate. Well, it didn't open terribly strongly... Too strong? Didn't open well.
Didn't open, yeah. Third place
with $23 million. The expectations weren't even that high for the Eddie Murphy movie. Imagine that. But it was still a disappointment at only $5.5
million. Mm-hmm.
Hangover was number one again for another week. And Up was number two.
And Hangover was the first movie to repeat number one since February.
Yeah, no kidding.
This year. We've had a new number one movie every weekend since February.
It only dropped about 23%, somewhere around there, since the previous week, which was the smallest drop in box office into week two for any movie this year. And they're saying that it's pretty much because of word of mouth. People are going to see it, loving it, and telling everybody that they talk to about it.
I still haven't seen it. I want to see it.
Well,
and we failed at trying to see it once couple weeks ago,
yeah.
and
from what I understand, it's still sold out quite often whenever showings are happening. You know, it's one of these movies now that has to fight for any of the screens that it's going on. So it's probably only getting into one or maybe two screens in a big multiplex. That'd be about it.
Yeah.
So you know, there are sellouts. It's good to see.
And there hasn't been anything really to compete with it since it came out.
Nothing
until Wednesday.
You're
when,
right. I mean,
when
you,
Transformers comes out.
Yeah, you look at
although it looks like The Proposal is going to be number one this weekend.
Really? Really?
Tongue in cheek.
The reviews have been okay. And you're right. I mean, obviously now there's a lack of comedy. If The Hangover is still number one, it's pretty much one of the only comedies up there. If you want, I don't know what you call Night at the Museum, a family movie. Is it a comedy?
It's a family movie. Land of the Lost
was supposed to be a mix of that sort of thing, too, but the reviews have been awful.
Big bomb for that one.
Pretty much a big bomb, exactly. Yep. Right, yeah. Anyway, some of the stories that we're going to look at this week include some interesting...
An end to the melodrama.
Yep, an end to the melodrama with SAG. We're going to look at a story about some innovative viral marketing for a particular movie coming up. A big-time sequel, a recasting for a iconic comic book and movie hero. Some news about some writers being assigned to a big-name sequel, and a couple of TV stories as well. But first, we're going to start off with Screen Actors Guild ratification of their labor pact.
Finally, it happened. a couple weeks ago, this was SAG officially ratified its proposed two-year contract deal on June 9th by an overwhelming margin of 78% to 22%. The SAG members had been working under the terms of their previous contract since June 30th, 2008. As we've said the past year, we've been following it on the blog and on the show. Negotiations have stopped and started, and it's just been an ongoing mess of nothing happening to make anything move forward. So it finally came down to it at the beginning of the month here, and the melodrama is finally over. So just to round this out, we were hearing through these negotiations a strong amount of opposition towards the deal, and
being led by Ed Harris.
Ed Harris. Oh my gosh! Did you see this video?
Yes.
I sent it to you, didn't I?
Yes,
yeah,
yes.
There was this video. Because that's one of the things that they were doing. They were like, you know,
it's campaign videos.
It was
really,
campaign videos. You know, Ed Harris was like, "This is why I'm voting no." Tom Hanks was like, "This is why I'm voting yes," even though it's not a perfect contract. Basically, it got to the point where everybody's like, either they strongly don't want it or they just want something done.
Yeah.
That was Tom Hanks's case, right?
Right.
And this is how it breaks down a little bit here. The vote count in the Hollywood division was 70% for to 29% against. In the New York division, the ratification ballots were 85% for to 14% against. And in the regional branch division, the count was 89% for the deal and 11% in favor. So this is where we were hearing the most opposition was out of Hollywood, which is why it was not as many people in favor of it. Screen Actors Guild's national board recommended the contract when the tentative deal was reached, you know, on April 19th, and it was only recommended by 53%, like a mere 53%. Of the national board said, you know what, this is the best we're going to get. Vote yes, or, you know, let's just get this going. The ballots went out on May 19th to the 110,000 or so members that are in good standing. And just kind of here's what's the little nuts and bolts of it. Among the terms of the new deal are a 3% wage increase in the first year and a 0.5% pension increase, health plan contribution increase. And in the second year of the contract, the wages will go up by 3.5%. The guild will benefit from $105 million in increases and contributions in the new pact, though it meant passing up close to another $100 million during this past year while the contract was remained unsolved. With the deal reached now, the focus has switched onto this fall's leadership campaign within the Screen Actors Guild, as SAG President Alan Rosenberg, who was seen as by many as the reason why the deals nothing was going through. He's seeking a third term. Nobody has yet announced their candidacy to compete against him. It's a two-year deal that expires on June 30th, 2011. That was the most recent stalemate in the deal. For the longest time, it was over new media residuals. And then a new media residuals were reached. And then what was the problem was the length of the new contract, whereas the normal new contract deals were 3 years. Because it took a year to get something going, SAG wanted a two-year deal to line them up with the Writers Guild and the Directors Guild and AFTRAs so they can all start renegotiations around the same time. So we can just be seeing this all over again in 2 years.
Well, you know, the state of the industry changes so quickly now. It's almost exponential, just like they say technology changes exponentially every few years. So as more and more avenues open up for people to enjoy the content that Hollywood and the movie and television industry make, then the more complicated these deals get, and it takes that much longer to finally work them out. There's it's been a lot of minutia, it's been a lot of back and forth, it's been a lot of struggle, and it's been fairly dry stuff, but it affects what everybody sees on their televisions.
Well, yeah, exactly. You know, there is just as a result of the stalemate, there was always since last June, there was always the actors were always in a legal position to just randomly strike, and nobody wanted to do that after the writer's strike. Which crumbled the industry in 07 and 08 into 08. But just as a result of this stalemate, you know, jobs were lost, productions were halted or slowed down or, you know, put on just dropped in entirely just because, you know, for fear of the actors walking off the job, at midnight one day. I mean, Terminator Salvation and Transformers almost didn't start because of fear of the actors going on strike when they started filming last spring. But fortunately, they didn't strike, and we've had two movies. And those movies are made, obviously.
For the first time in years, Fox is going to launch its TV lineup in mid to late September, along with most of the other networks. Though some of the programs are going to debut during the official start of season premiere week beginning September 21st. Most of its primetime programs will begin within a few days of that traditional launch period. So let's start by looking at Thursday, September 17th, which is the first night of their premiere schedule. You're going to see Bones and Fringe debut on Thursday night. On Friday night, we've got Brothers Till Death and Dollhouse. A big surprise that's coming back, of course. Mm-hmm. On Monday, September 21st, we have the two-hour premiere of House, which is going to be a big deal for Fox and a great ratings win. I mean, you can automatically assume that.
Oh, yeah.
On Sunday, September...
You'll find out in a minute.
Yeah, exactly. On Sunday, September 27th, we've got the season premiere of The Simpsons and the series premiere of the Family Guy spinoff, The Cleveland Show. And at 9 o'clock on Fox, we've got Family Guy and then American Dad at 9:30.
That's their bringing back their traditional Sunday animation block.
Right.
You notice that Cleveland Show is in the slot of King of the Hill, which ended its run.
Yeah, and you know what? That is probably going to be a ratings win for these guys.
I'm excited about Cleveland.
Yeah, it should be. Should be really good. On Monday, we've got the following Monday, the September 28th, we've got an all-new episode of House and then the season premiere of Lie to Me. So that's what's going on for the big shows over on the Fox network. We'll hear, I'm sure, from CBS, ABC, and NBC, as well as the other cable networks fairly shortly.
Yeah, and it's interesting. The reason why Fox for the past few years, I should mention, is they've been kind of spontaneous with their premiere weeks. You know, some of them premiering shows in August, late August, or early October, and that's all because of the World Series. Fox owns the rights to air the World Series, which takes place, you know, in September.
And The Simpsons usually wouldn't even premiere until
Halloween.
It was horrible. Yeah, the first episode, technically the first new episode would be the Halloween show, but the first original episode would be the one after that or the one even after sometimes the Super Bowl, which was just weird.
So... That's Fox. They're the first network to announce their premiere week. As more networks announce when their shows are coming back, we'll let you know. But on to a related topic. This is why House is going to be such a big deal. This is why Hugh Laurie is the most paid actor, highest paid actor on television. And it is because, according to ratings agency Eurodata TV Worldwide, House in 2008 garnered more than 81.8 million viewers in 66 countries, which represented a potential of 1.6 billion viewers worldwide, making it the most watched show in the world. And that was far more than 2007 and 2006 winners, which were CSI and CSI Miami, respectively. Also, in the same report that announced House as the most viewed show in the world, they had a comedy category where Desperate Housewives, for the second year running, beat out Monk and Ugly Betty, with its attracting 65.3 million viewers worldwide in 2008. And in the soap opera category, The Bold and the Beautiful was the most popular soap for a second year running, thrashing the Mexican telenova show Marina and The Young and the Restless with 24.5 million viewers. This is why, as I said, it's the highest rated show on Fox next to American Idol, and why Hugh Laurie is the highest paid actor right now.
Yeah,
because everybody in the world's watching
him. I think it's great. I think it's good to finally see CSI and CSI Miami and CSI New York and CSI Pittsburgh and CSI Seattle all come out of that bloody list. It's interesting to see that that Desperate Housewives is the highest watched or the most watched TV comedy. Mm-hmm. I forget about Desperate Housewives. I forget that it's a comedy. It's kind of weird.
Yeah.
It's just not, you know, it's a prime example of something that's a directly targeted show. It's targeted maybe at a certain audience, and I'm certainly not it.
No.
I'm a bit surprised to see The Bold and the Beautiful is the most watched soap opera, because it's not what gets the highest ratings. So it's interesting that they can, you know, there's two different ways to measure it. You can measure with Nielsen ratings, where they have a sample audience, mm-hmm. and it's typically in North America or even just the U.S., and then they also have this Eurodata information that shows who's watching around the world. And I think that's probably more valuable information to have. But for advertisers, they just want to know who's watching in their particular market, even if market's an entire country.
Yep.
All right, so let's move on to some new movie news. We've got information about the brand new James Bond movie. This will be the third one for Daniel Craig. The movie project has now announced it has writers attached. Neil Purvis and Robert Wade, who've co-written the past four James Bond features, will be joined by Peter Morgan on the next installment of the franchise. And the three writers will collaborate on the screenplay for the next Bond movie, which will be the 23rd film. And the triple hiring fills the pattern of the two most recent movies, Casino Royale and Quantum of Solace, which saw Purvis and Wade drafting the initial script, and Oscar-winning writer-director Paul Haggis coming in on top of it to augment it. Purvis and Wade have written together on The Italian Job, Johnny English, and Plunkett and McLean. Right now they have the sequel, The Brazilian Job, in development. And Morgan's recently seen such successes recently with The Queen, The Last King of Scotland, and Frost Nixon. A great pedigree there.
It is.
Or should I say great resume. No director, of course, has been attached, because that would be a huge announcement. But MGM was at one point seeking out Paul Haggis for the job. Hasn't directed anything.
Not recently. Since Crash, as far as I know. He's just been writing and producing.
So it's you know, it's good to bring in a little fresh blood. I don't know whether Haggis would have contributed to Quantum of Solace in a positive or a negative way, because everybody loved Casino Royale so much, and we're not sure exactly what type of work that Paul Haggis did on it, but yeah. You got to figure it was good work.
He's definitely a sought after writer.
I mean, sure.
He was also given the script for Terminator Salvation.
All right.
Do fix ups with that with Terminator Salvation alongside with Jonathan Nolan. Right. Paul Haggis, they wanted him to direct the Quantum of Solace, but he just stuck with the writing. And he actually got the final draft of the script in, like, literally the day before the writer's strike for Quantum of Solace.
Really?
Yeah. I remember I was reading he was working feverishly trying to, you know, put the finishing touches on there. But, yes, I like the addition of Morgan. I mean, The Queen, Last King of Scotland, and Frost Nixon, all great movies, especially Frost Nixon. And The Last Game of Scotland kind of just really exploded James McAvoy a little bit more. I mean, he was introduced to the world in The Chronicles of Narnia, but Last King of Scotland kind of got him dramatic recognition. And now I'm just blabbering on, but I just like those three movies.
So you've got some casting news now for us for some pretty high-profile TV show.
Yeah, well, for fans of Grey's Anatomy, there's been a kind of a mystery up in the air with after the season finale this past May, with regards of two stars,
right,
who are on the show, and answers were given this week. As on Friday, ABC confirmed that T.R. Knight will not be returning to Grey's Anatomy next season. Knight had previously asked to be released from his contract on the show, And in this past season finale, his character, Dr. George O'Malley, flatlined after being hit by a bus. It was a cliffhanger, obviously, and they were wondering, well, was he going to come out? Did he die? Was he in a coma? What's going to happen? And a similar situation occurred with the character Izzy, played by Katherine Heigl, who ABC has announced will return, in fact, to the show in the fall. Izzy's character was diagnosed with stage 4 metastatic cancer in the brain and liver. And in the season finale, she underwent successful brain surgery, but lost her short-term memory in the process, and also flatlined during the final minutes of the finale in May, leaving the cliffhanger, is she going to die? Heigl's return is good news for the show, as tensions between herself and the producers have been in the headlines over the past couple of years. Grey's Anatomy, of course, made her a household name, earned her an Emmy in 2007, and launched her movie career. But tensions began to creep in last summer when Heigl pulled herself out of Emmy consideration, attributed her decision to do that to a lack of good stories for her character. At the time, she'd also been rumored to have lobbied for a release from the show to focus on her movie career. However, this past season, the storyline of Izzy's cancer was central to the show's creative comeback. And additionally, Heigl has said publicly that she wants to continue on with the show. So, fans of Grey's Anatomy, there you go.
She's kind of developed a reputation, whether it be founded or not, that she's difficult and a bit of a pill. But obviously her work is valued. She's a good actress, and like they said, the show was in a bit of a slump, and when they focused the show back on her character again, ratings increased and the show got better. Her movies have been small, but her performance has been good. You got to admit she's gorgeous, and she's got this reputation. I don't know. Some women love her, some women hate her as a celebrity, as an actor. She's pretty outspoken, and I think that is still in some ways frowned upon in Hollywood. She's kind of like that in the same way that Megan Fox, really just, they don't really care what they say as much. They're not going to be wallflowers. They're not going to be pushovers.
Right.
They're pretty outspoken, and they're probably a publicist nightmare.
Yeah, and
they do good work.
With Grey's Anatomy, it's not the first time that we've heard of tensions in the background. There was the whole thing with Isaiah Washington a couple years ago with... If I'm not mistaken, it was racism, right?
Yeah.
Right? And he resulted in him leaving the show. And
it wasn't racism. It was homophobia.
Homophobia because of T.R. Knight. Yeah. That's right. I'm thinking there was a link.
Knight. Yeah.
T.R. Knight came out of the closet, right? And apparently...
And Isaiah said some pretty derogatory things about him.
Derogatory things. That
allegedly.
Ended up in Isaiah's character being just written off of the show completely.
Okay, so let's move on to an interesting little, almost a film history story here. The family of Walt Disney is unveiling a museum to tell the story of the animation pioneer they say has been lost behind the trademark. The Walt Disney Family Foundation, a nonprofit organization that was established back in 1995 to promote education and writing about Disney, as well as scholarships in his name, they're going to open the Walt Disney Family Museum in October in San Francisco. The museum will trace Walt Disney's life from his birth in Chicago and childhood in Missouri to his move to California in the 1920s. That's when he got married and his animation career took off with the creation of Mickey Mouse. Among the exhibits on display will be early animation drawings, film clips, scripts, cameras, and many of Disney's numerous Academy Awards, including an honorary Oscar in 1939 for his first feature-length animation film, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. Probably back then there was no such thing.
It was the first feature-length animated show.
And there's no award for it.
Yeah. Now there is.
Yeah, up until recently, actually, I don't think there was an award for feature-length animation.
Not until Toy Story 2, yeah, I think, yeah. Which is another Disney movie.
Yeah, they were competing with live action, I guess. Well, not really in Hollywood's eyes. There will also be, of course, a model of Disneyland, the theme park he first envisioned. It's quite different from the park that opened in California in 1955. They're also going to have a model of the Lily Bell train that ran on a half a mile of track around his Hollywood home. John Canemaker an Academy Award-winning animator and animation studies professor at NYU, said that the launch, that Disney's development of personality animation, beginning with Mickey Mouse, revolutionized the industry. Richard Benefield, executive director of the museum, said that the Walt Disney Company had made its resources and archives available to the foundation and loaned several exhibits to the museum. This is the kind of thing I think that is an interesting, it's going to make an interesting tourist destination for San Francisco.
Definitely.
It's a little more educational, intellectual, and say an amusement park would be, obviously being in a museum form. But it's going to be really something that I think a lot of people will flock to. There's a lot of people who are real devotees and, you know, armchair experts of animation.
Well, you know, I for one, you know, agree with the Disney family when they say that, you know, when you hear Walt Disney, you don't think of the actual person anymore. You know, you just think of the brand because it's everywhere.
Oh, sure.
Right? And, you know, people, you know, have often, he passed away in 1966, I think it was. You know, people, you know, often forget or, you know, not knowingly forget, you know, that he was a person. And so that's kind of what they wanted to do here. They opened up the museum to, you know, kind of remind people about everything that Walt Disney did. And I, for one, just wanted to say I've written two essays in college courses about Walt Disney and how I argued him to be the most influential character of the 20th century. If I have them, I might send it to you. I don't know if I still have them.
That'd be cool, yeah.
But both assignments got me A pluses.
Really?
Right? So when I saw this, I mean, I've read two biographies on the guy, wrote the two essays, and he had a really, really interesting life. You know, I couldn't put that biography down. His and Tim Allen's, they're the
now,
only
what
two biographies I've read.
What do you think about any of the negative allegations towards him regarding anti-Semitism and that sort of thing?
I don't know. I just shrug it off. I can't really find any real basis. I don't think he's cryogenically frozen, though. But I mean, yeah, I don't know. I haven't paid attention enough to those allegations to have form a real opinion.
Were they approached at all in the books you read?
No.
No? Really?
Yeah. Oh. I know he served for the U.S. He was running an ambulance on the field. I know that the U.S. government during World War II enlisted Walt Disney and his animation studio to do propaganda films, quote-unquote films.
That's right.
Glorifying the war and shunning Hitler. And in fact, a class that I took a couple years ago, A History of Cinema, we watched a couple of them. And I'm sure you could find them on YouTube.
Right.
Like I said, it's just an interesting life that he had, that he led, and, you know, this creation of Mickey Mouse, which led to Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, which led to many animated movies, which then led to animation and real-life actors and Who Framed Roger Rabbit coming in to, you know, of course, Toy Story, which revolutionized yet again the animation industry with computer graphics and 3D, which now, you know, nobody is doing anymore theatrically, really, traditional animated movies.
Oh, no, line-drawn animation.
Line-drawn animation. It's done.
Yeah.
In fact, the last Disney movie officially was Brother Bear.
Yeah, and when Pixar took over, when John Lasseter took over Disney Animation altogether, that pretty much was a nail in the coffin for that sort of thing.
Yeah.
I don't know if Disney's I don't know if they're still putting out line drawn animation on video or not on DVD. I haven't seen any. I thought maybe they're still. Are they still turning out those awful sequels?
Well,
John Lasseter announced he was ending that.
That was going to end with the last one that they released. I think is that's just kind of, you know, you've had these, like, you know, Brother Bear 2 and then this Moose movie and then the Lion King 1.5, which I actually enjoyed Lion King 1.5. They had Tinkerbell.
Oh, that's right.
That came out earlier this year, straight to DVD.
Just the thought.
That was supposed to be the last straight to DVD BS sequel.
It's funny how that
money grab is what it
yeah,
was.
Yeah, it's funny how all these films have still maintained their image of being Well, maybe they haven't, but in my opinion, they have an image of being something that just should not be tampered with in any way, shape, or form.
Oh, exactly. Do not try and remake Mary Poppins. Not try this Alice in Wonderland by Tim Burton. Come on. I mean, I know that wasn't Disney's story. It was based on a book, but it truly had, you know, these are timeless movies. People watch them over and over again, you know. I watched Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs when I was a kid, and Bambi and the Jungle Book and Mary Poppins, and they just have this staying power, right? Because now I'm with my friend's 4-year-old niece watching 101 Dalmatians on DVD, right? And I'm like, I watched that as a kid too. Yeah. It's they're timeless. They're never ending.
I guess the argument could be is that if 102 Dalmatians is going to be made, at least it's being made by Disney. But the counter argument is it should never be made. Okay, so speaking of remakes, you've got really interesting and ironic news regarding what I believe is the very first Marvel Comics character to get its own live-action feature film, and that took place way back in the 80s.
And now way back in the 80s.
And now
was it the first? No, that was it the 80s?
Maybe it's even late 70s.
I think it was late 70s.
Late 70s, yeah. Anyway, being remade, that'd be Conan the Barbarian.
Yeah, the latest in the world of remakes we were just talking about here. Lionsgate and New Image Millennium, the two companies behind the Conan reboot, might have found their new Conan, and he bears a striking similarities to the old Conan. The companies are in talks with a 41-year-old Australian actor named Roland Kickinger, to play the title role that Arnold Schwarzenegger made famous in 1982.
Oh, man, I'm tired of being right.
There are more than a few eerie parallels between the personalities. Like Schwarzenegger, Kickinger is a bodybuilder turned actor from the Central European country. Like the California governor, he also had a role as the T-800 in the Terminator franchise, in Terminator Salvation.
He played the actual T-800, and they just keyed in Arnold's face over his face.
And in a You Can't Make This Stuff Up turn, Kickinger actually played the Conan-era version of Schwarzenegger in the TV movie See Arnold Run, which was an A&E biopic about Schwarzenegger, the actor-turned-politician. Universal's original Conan, which vaulted Schwarzenegger to fame and a slew of action tentpoles, follows a man who seeks revenge on the person who sold him into slavery. A few details of the new pick have been revealed, though the character is expected to be given a polish, with the filmmaker drawing influences from more recent action picks. Shooting will begin in the fall at Avi Lerner's Bulgaria-based studio. Marcus Nispel, who helmed the Friday the 13th reboot, is set to direct it. And no word on whether Arnold will make a cameo. And interesting enough, I haven't found anything concrete to base this on. Schwarzenegger is next year finishes his 2-year terms as the governor. And I heard somewhere that he's planning on going back to movies in 2010. So you never know.
I bet you he misses it.
He probably does.
Yeah. It's a very interesting story. If any Howard Stern listeners are out there, I'm sure if he hasn't already, he's going to take credit for this guy's rise to fame. Roland Kickinger was originally on the Howard Stern produced comedy Son of the Beach. And I remember him from that way back then. So he's been around Hollywood for a little while, but the guy's in incredible shape and bears a remarkable resemblance to Arnold, even without actually using CGI to make him look exactly like Arnold, like they did in Terminator Salvation. But he's going to be cool, I think. And it'll be interesting to see if...
Do we want another Conan movie?
Well, I don't think the story is really good. The material was good. The Marvel comic was pretty cool.
I know they've been trying to get Conan back on the map. They did a game, was released 2 years ago, which completely bombed, and nobody liked it. But maybe that's what it needs.
The original film was cool. I think James Earl Jones was the villain in either the first one or the second one.
Yeah, he was. I remember.
Yeah, second one I think was Grace Jones, maybe? Anyway, you know, it was cool, but I don't think that younger audiences are going to go back and watch a 25-year-old action movie with Arnold Schwarzenegger unless they're huge Arnold fans. So this might be the kind of movie that could benefit from a remake. Who knows?
You never know. True enough.
Speaking of old properties, here's one, a story that I am really interested in. I'm looking forward to seeing Mission Impossible 4. It once seemed truly impossible.
Wait, I did the wrong music, right?
No, that was right. Da-na-na. Anyway, it looks like it's taking shape at Paramount Pictures. Despite the fact that Mission Impossible 4 was the lowest in the box office. Mission Impossible 3 right. was the lowest in the box office of all three. Many people consider it to be one of the best, if not the best made Mission Impossible film.
I've recently changed my opinion on that.
It was my opinion that when that film came out, it was a victim of Tom Cruise's insanity.
Yeah.
That was at the height of the couch-jumping, Scientology, flag-waving nonsense that was going on. And he completely lost the female audience with his little feud about antidepressants with Brooke Shields, and postpartum depression was a big subject that was going on right then. And I think that really affected the box office for Mission Impossible 3. But it looks like J.J. Abrams has agreed to co-produce this time with Tom Cruise. And they're looking at a 2011 release date. The return of Tom Cruise to Paramount itself is surprising in view of the circumstances surrounding his departure in August 2006. This was one of the very first stories that we featured on Inside Movies and TV, actually. Apparently, he was irked by the heft of Cruise's deal, among other issues. Chief at Viacom, Sumner Redstone, abruptly terminated the 14-year relationship between Tom Cruise and Paramount Pictures. His agent at CAA, Rick Nassita, termed Redstone's decision shockingly offensive and graceless. The rift led to Tom Cruise becoming the chief of United Artists and taking a more active role in production decisions. Sumner Redstone, meanwhile, has sought to heal the relationship at a recent appearance. He described the star as a great actor and a good friend. The Mission Impossible installment would augment Paramount's formidable array of sequels, which will also include Star Trek II, also produced and most likely directed by J.J. Abrams, and a third Transformers movie. So no matter
how, that in 2011?
Yeah, not necessarily in 2011, but there's sequels that would be upcoming.
Okay.
I think that, you know what, Transformers 3 might be in 2011 because it's only been 2 years since the first Transformers.
And I think Star Trek 2 has basically got its 2011.
And no matter what the critics say about Transformers, this is one of these films that's critic-proof. There will be a sequel. Anyway, work on Mission Impossible 4 would inevitably be delayed by the busy schedule of all the people involved. J.J. Abrams, of course, is going to be working on the Star Trek sequel right away, if not right now.
Right.
While Tom Cruise recently committed to an untitled movie formerly called Wichita for 20th Century Fox. It's going to be directed by James Mangold, and it's going to co-star Cameron Diaz.
James Mangold directed Walk the Line and 310 to Yuma.
Mm-hmm. Cruise and Denzel Washington, they're also going to they're also awaiting a rewrite on a David Cronenberg movie called The Matarese Circle. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. Matarese Circle. It's a thriller over at MGM based on the Robert Ludlum novel. So lots going on in that front. I hope that we will see Mission Impossible 4. I love that whole Mission Impossible franchise, just the idea of it. I love the TV show. When I was a kid, there was a remake that they had with Peter Graves back in the 80s. And it's been ripped off by all kinds of different people and different producers, both in television and in film. But nothing beats the original Mission Impossible.
The original, the show? Or the first movie?
Just the whole idea, the whole concept, the brand name of Mission Impossible.
It was funny. We were talking about Mission Impossible a couple weeks back there, how I recently rewatched all of them, and I was a big fan of MI2 for some unknown reason. I forgot now.
I know. When you're rewatching now, you're like, oh, like, man, what was I thinking?
How does he know all of these moves he didn't know in the first movie? All this jumping roundhouse martial arts. And, it's John Woo. I mean, it was cool. It was explosives, but it wasn't a strong story.
No, and at its core, Mission Impossible works best when it's a team.
Exactly.
Tom Cruise, back then, he was not terribly a team player, and it was him and then everybody else in tiny roles.
The red or the long brown hair and the white going back and forth. And when Mission Impossible 3 came out, I was a critic of it because I guess, I fell victim to the whole Tom Cruise fiasco that was going on at the time. And I wasn't into J.J. Abrams and Lost at the time,
right.
And I since have been. And Philip Seymour Hoffman was the great villain. So I think, watch MI3 again if you haven't already, and you might be swayed differently. I still think the first one's the best, followed by the third one. And I want to know what inspired Paramount. Like, how much they paid Anthony Hopkins to show up for one day on set in Mission Impossible 2. He had two scenes in the movie.
Probably didn't cost that much. He wasn't doing a heck of a lot that was, you know, prominent at the time, I think.
Story-wise, though, they kind of set up stuff in J.J. Abrams' style after Mission Impossible 3, this rabbit's foot thing.
That's classic J.J. Abrams.
And it, it opened at... Again, and I understand why now, because the way they opened it with the first scene at the wedding party, the movie would, nobody would be paying attention. But they opened it with this interrogation scene, and then they just meshed it all into the together, and that was actually the middle of the movie, and then all hell breaks loose. Anyways, I'm rambling
on. One of the big criticisms of Mission Impossible 3, and it's a little bit warranted, is that it's basically an extended episode of Alias. In fact, there are episodes of Alias, I think even a season premiere of season 3, that opens the same way as Mission Impossible 3, with her captured, being questioned, et cetera, and then they flash back for the rest of the show.
Mm-hmm.
So,
very J.J. Abrams.
And the writers involved were writers on Alias as well. Now, whether you want to take that as a criticism or not, I'm not sure, because back then Alias... was a fantastic action-adventure show, spy-oriented action-adventure show. And then it kind of spiraled a little bit out of control towards the end.
Thank you for calling the Multinational United Hotline. Listen carefully to the following options. Non-humans have escaped from District 9 and are deemed to be violent and unpredictable. Press 1 to report any non-human sightings in your area. Press 2... for more information on careers at Multinational United. To speak with an MNU representative, please press 0 or visit us at www.multinationalunited.com. Press star at any time to return to this main menu.
Okay, and our last story of the podcast is regarding some advertising for an upcoming film that's creating a lot of stir. The perplexing public service announcements for this particular movie began turning up a few weeks ago. They splashed across bus stop ads in America's 15 biggest cities, as well as here in Canada. Bus benches for humans only, the ad banner copy proclaims, accompanied by a rough rendering of an outer space alien that has been crossed out Ghostbuster style with a strike-through circle. Beware, non-human secretions may corrode metal.
And if you happen to be among the tens of thousands of inquiring minds who have called the posted telephone number, which is listed beneath the ominous-sounding imperative, report non-humans, or punch in the website d9.com, into an internet browser, you may already know that the ad's true purpose, what they are, and that they are part of a viral marketing campaign for Sony Pictures' documentary-style sci-fi thriller, District 9, which doesn't arrive in theaters until August.
Mark Weinstock, who's the co-president of worldwide theatrical marketing for Sony, has said that they wanted to do something provocative and that it would create a stir. They had no idea with what extent they'd connect. And Sony's president of digital marketing, Dwight Kanes, said in 2 weeks there have been 33,000 phone calls to this phone number. 2,500 people left voice messages about alien sightings. And 92% of those calls came from cell phones, indicating that the people are opting in on the spot, on the street, right as they see the phone number.
Of course, by their very nature, viral movie marketing campaigns, of course, rely upon a temporary suspension of disbelief. After the initial confusion wears off, as the operating principle goes, people will agree to play along with what is essentially a massively scaled practical joke. And by extension, tell a friend about it and then go see the movie. Predictated on the understanding that there will be a big reveal to make it all worthwhile. Ever since the viral marketing impact of 1999's The Blair Witch Project, which had movie fans wondering whether the low-budget indie horror flick was actually a documentary gone horribly wrong, virals have been the stuff of fanboy dreams and movie marketer reverie in terms of low-cost, high-yield buzz.
Now, District 9's stealth campaign has already accomplished what a widely diverse array of virals unleashed on an unsuspecting public this year could not, which is a standout from the pack. The beachhead for its high-minded meta-narrative promo push is the movie's website listed on bus benches, bus shelters, and billboards. It's D-9 or D-9.com. And it not only streams the movie's trailer, which has been viewed 21 million times since May 1st, another indicator of a robust viewer interest, but the website also serves as a primer to the self-contained world of District 9, detailing security guidelines for humans and non-humans.
The film is filmed in a quasi-documentary style. District 9 is a $30 million special effects-heavy film from newcomer Neil Blomkamp. It follows the social and geopolitical repercussions of aliens crash-landing in Johannesburg. They have governmentally been sequestered in an apartheid-style homeland, treated like refugees, and forced to work for humans. District 9 producer Peter Jackson took pains to elucidate the differences between the movie and another mock documentary sci-fi thriller popularized by a much blogged about a viral campaign. He said, "It's a unique take on the science fiction genre. It has dramatized sequences and uses home movie clips, but it's not like Cloverfield, which was one of the first movies that used, well, I shouldn't say one of the biggest movies recently to use viral marketing to its advantage. But unlike Cloverfield, Peter Jackson says, it doesn't remind you of anyone else that, mind you, remind you that anyone else is in the movie."
The publicity really doesn't remind you of anybody else's movie either. The movie's offline promotions employ signage that deliberately echoes whites-only placards once seen in the South, as well as cultural touchstones from District 9. Blomkamp's upbringing in apartheid-era South Africa, warning, restricted area for humans only, reads as an ad painted on a New York City wall. It's the kind of thing that, you know, they're getting some controversy because apartheid wasn't that long ago. And this movie is actually set in South Africa, directed by a South African director. So you can understand where a lot of this emotion is coming from.
Yeah. It's the latest thing in viral in movie advertising. It's shown, it's not meant to be controversial, but clearly it's coming off as that. We've seen that in numerous ad campaigns. Zach and Miri last summer, certain signs had to, censor the word porno because people thought it would be offended by offended that kids would see it and be like, "Oh, mommy, what's a porno?" But viral marketing, it works. It gets butts in the seats, and this movie is coming out in the drudges of August. I think the same weekend or the weekend after G.I. Joe. And, it's as a result of all of this interest, 21 million viewers, 33,000 calls over the last 2 weeks, 500 people leaving voice messages. All of this stuff shows that the viral marketing, it works. And, like I said, it comes out in August, and, we're only in late June here, so the movie's going to make money as a result of it. We saw it in Cloverfield.
Yeah, you want to bet they're spending a lot of money on the marketing for this film. It's a small budget movie, especially considering all the effects, only at $30 million. It's opening in a summer that has movies like Star Trek and G.I. Joe and Transformers 2. So it's got to be able to compete. And what's one of the best ways a small movie like this can generate some buzz? And that's a viral marketing campaign that's well thought out and well executed. And that looks exactly like what they've done here. If you want to take a look at the kind of feel that this movie might have, you can go to YouTube and check out Neil Blomkamp's YouTube movie, Alive in Joburg. Just search for Alive in Joburg, and you'll get pretty much exactly what this movie's going to look and feel like, including some pretty cool special effects.
Well, yeah, that trailer, the trailer for it, we were talking about it on the last show, Peter Jackson story about him going to Comic-Con for the first time ever. You couldn't tell for a while that it was a movie preview.
Right.
It's done documentary style. And, this is going to probably be, one of the hidden gems of the summer. Definitely has got my interest peak. And as you heard just before we started the story, that message was the message that you got I recorded off of my cell phone. When you call the 1-866 number, which is 1-866-666-6001. So check it out. It's just good. It's a good, just for a good laugh, And I think that does it.
that should wrap things up for this week. Pretty good week as far as news is concerned. Not a lot of negativity. Lots of good news. A good news week for Inside Movies and TV. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you, Aaron, for continuing to maintain the blog and putting together this week's show. And to you, thank you for listening and checking out the blog. You can find it at moviesandtvcast.blogspot.com. And, of course, the website, imtv.podomatic.com, as well as on iTunes. Feel free to send us your suggestions, comments, queries, insults, and cease and desist orders at our Gmail site. You can email us at moviesandtvcast@gmail.com. Let the credits roll! Don't let the credits roll! Turn this movie on, and if we don't, we might as well.